Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is Adam Savage. He's the star of Discovery Channel's Mythbusters, and he's one of our favorite makers. Adam's been on the show before, and he's back this time with five tools to talk about. He's also got a new book out called Every Tool's a Hammer. And here's how Adam describes that book. Through stories from 40-plus years of making and molding, building and breaking, along with the lessons I learned along the way, this book is meant to be a toolbox of problem-solving, complete with a shop's worth of notes on the tools, techniques, and materials that I use most often. So for this episode, Kevin actually went to Adam's workshop and interviewed him there. So I'm not on this episode, so I will just let them take it away.
I'm here with Adam Savage in his marvelous workshop, his fantastic museum of creation, and we're going to talk about some of his four favorite tools, and then we'll get into his most recent book. So Adam, we're surrounded by, I don't know, several hundred thousand tools, I would imagine, at this point. And you are, continue to be a maker, making your own stuff, making stuff for various reasons. But I'm really curious of what some of your four favorite tools are. Maybe you can walk us through. What's a tool that you're kind of really liking these days?
Yeah, well, I have five tools. Two are in an almost identical category. And some of them have been with me for a while, and I've only just recently gotten to connect with their incredible utility, and some I have just found out about. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to start with the oldest one, which is this thing right here.
Ah, it's a massive hunk of iron.
It is a Pelican case, about, I guess, probably 17 by 13 by 7 inches or so. Uh-huh. This is a battery-powered MIG welder.
So battery-powered mean that you could work with this anywhere.
Yeah, which means this Pelican case is all that you need to lay down a weld bead. You don't need gas. You don't need to connect it to anything. And while it weighs about 45 pounds, I bought this during Mythbusters, and there were a couple of times it saved our ass. We like carried it to the top of a crane to take care of something that we couldn't have taken care of any other way. But on the new show I have coming up on Science Channel, Savage Builds, this thing was a completely mission critical tool, like on almost every episode.
Because it allows you to weld in places that ordinarily the equipment would be too cumbersome, awkward.
Yeah, and when you start to run long strings of 120 volt power cords, you lose amperage over distance. You waste heat, and it's hard to get, your welder works less good at the end of 400 feet of extension cords than it does out of the wall.
So I would imagine with the way batteries are improving over time that basically this is sort of like the batteries that we'd be using in a car.
Actually, funnily enough, these are still two gel cells in here, although I now want to upgrade them to something more robust with better cycling.
Okay, all right.
This also can be hooked up to gas if you want to, but in general, I keep flux core wire in it so that it creates its own gas envelope. What I also love about this is I just watched Aliens the other night for the first time in a few years, and it's still a perfect movie. And there's all these points at which the Marines are like, okay, close that door, weld it. And they're welding the door shut. And I'm like, that's not science fiction. You could carry this welder on the back of a Marine and weld the door shut behind you.
I guess if you were really only going to do a very short amount of welding for a short amount of time, you could even have a smaller battery. You could backpack it in.
Indeed. This thing has two big 12-volt gel cells and can lay down something like 70 minutes of bead.
Right, but if you only needed 5 minutes...
Yeah, no, then you could probably strap it to your arm. Wow, now that's something I want to... Oh, now I'm getting excited.
A new tool. Mm-hmm. So what is this called? And can you buy one now, today?
Absolutely. Hobart.
Okay.
Which has been a sponsor of Mythbusters, and I can't remember if they were one of my sponsors on Being Savage, although I should know that. I bought this from them.
So it's a Hobart something?
It's a Hobart battery-powered welder.
Okay.
Again, I think they're about $600 to $800.
Right. Okay.
And it's about 45 pounds, and you know, this would be, along with a generator, one of the most important parts of my bug out kit at the end of Civilization, which might be a couple of weeks away.
Yeah, you'd be a very popular guy.
I'll meet you in the permafrost.
Be a very popular guy.
Just have to make sure
Solar charged.
Yep.
You can solar charge this.
Oh, yeah. No, it's all part of this. There's a spot on my Land Cruiser for this.
Well, that's wonderful. Okay, so the Hobart battery-powered MIG is a MIG welder.
Yeah.
And MIG means that it's wire...
inert gas. Yeah, so it means that it creates... The wire is constantly fed out of the tip while it arcs, which melts the wire into the steel weldment. And you have a gas envelope around that so it doesn't oxidize. And that gas envelope is created by either connecting argon CO2 into the welder, or you can use flux core wire that I've described, which has a flux in the center of the wire that creates a messier gas envelope. The welds aren't as nice, but they are close to as strong.
Right. That's the kind of welding I learned, as you know, just from watching YouTube videos.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the cheapest way to start.
Exactly.
So what's another tool that you are... fawning over these days?
Well, I haven't mentioned these things at all to anyone yet. These are Gilbau nippers. That is a straight, that's a slightly curved one.
Yes.
And this is a straight one.
So these things look like a pliers or, you know, like a scissors or a nipper.
Yeah.
They're fit in your hand. They seem very rugged and old school.
They do. This one I'm holding is a Gilbau, G-I-L-B-O-W, G56, and this one is a Gilbau G0. This is G56, and this is G056. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I found out about these while working on that suit of armor there with Terry English in Cornwall, England. Terry is the armorer for Excalibur. I've mentioned him on your podcast before. And he pulled one of these out to cut through some fairly heavy aluminum in this precise way to get around this thing. And I was like, I love the idea of a non-power tool making these tiny little precise cuts in aluminum to do the shaping he was doing. And he made these things really sing in his hands.
And normally, you might try to use like a snips, a Weiss snip.
Yeah, snips or a nibbler.
It's a sheet metal.
Right.
And these are similar, but more, it looks like they're more rugged.
They're more rugged, and they're made with a tolerance that, like, you can really clamp down it, and you can feel it just like it wants to cut through a fairly reasonable gauge of aluminum.
Okay.
Copper. Yeah, and I am always on the lookout for little hand tools that I have never seen before. So when I saw him operating these, I was like, hand these over, I got to take a picture.
And with these, so this is, the brand is Gilbau.
Yeah.
And presumably still online somewhere.
Well, and the pair that Terry was using was probably 35 to 40 years old.
Right.
And I was really pleased to see that Gilbau was still in business, still making tools, and they seemed every bit as awesome as they always were.
That is a testament.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always like finding an old tool that's still being made by the same company.
Yeah, like some of those Yankee hammer nail pullers and things. The original design, they're still manufactured
the
exactly
nail puller.
The same.
Oh, my God. That is one of my favorite tools of all time. Especially since almost, like, I rarely run into any maker who is familiar with them. And I love going, guess what this does?
If you have a lot of old floorboards, this is what you want.
Yeah, somebody told me, I did show it to someone who said, yeah, I spent a summer tearing out every nail in a floor with that damn thing.
So what else do we have here? He's holding a little brass, almost looks like a little brass boat.
It does, doesn't it?
It's a little basin of brass metal about the size of a thumb.
Yep.
Almost like a thumb case, but it actually is a plane.
It is a plane with a convex bottom.
Ooh.
And
plane meaning to shave wood.
Yes. Yeah, so it's got a hardened steel blade that sticks out of a flat on the bottom. And this is meant for planing out the inside of the back of a violin.
Whoa.
And this comes about from I'm always on the search uh-huh. for industries that are using things I haven't seen before. Uh-huh. And I've been watching a lot of luthiers and violin uh-huh. makers uh-huh. over the last couple of years on YouTube because uh-huh. I love watching that precision uh-huh. and the slow methodical pace. And I saw this plane and I thought, wow, let me see. These are not expensive in by any stretch of the imagination, between $20 and $30 for one mm-hmm. of these.
And what would you use it for, other than planing the back of your violin?
I have used it for a bunch of woodwork stuff over the past few months.
Just when you need a little very fine
a
amount
little,
of...
Yeah, a fine touch.
Instead of like grinding it or sanding it.
Exactly. There comes this point when you're first sanding with sandpaper, you think, and I'm moving my hands vigorously, that sanding is all of this action. And one of the things I was shocked to discover when I became... when my talent as a model maker improved, was that the last aspect of sanding is literally holding something and going shunk with one pass and looking and making sure, okay, no, shunk, and it's just one more. It's these tiny little single increments of sanding. And this plane gives me about the same kind of precision.
Right.
There's a sculptor I worked with at Industrial Light and Magic named Ira Keeler. Mm-hmm. And Ira is this old timer who'd been around forever. And when you wanted to vacuum, like for the film Mission Impossible, mm-hmm. where the helicopter, the first Mission Impossible film where the helicopter crashes in the tunnel, mm-hmm. that was done as a practical effect. And the cars in the tunnel were all model cars about 2 feet long. And Ira sat there for weeks with big chunks of basswood and using
carved
almost a finger plane. This is a thumb plane, but a slightly bigger finger plane. I think it was literally like Craftsman's classic little finger plane. Mm-hmm. It's like about 2 inches by 3 inches. He just plane a Citroen or whatever car you wanted out of basswood, and then they'd vacuum form it and they'd make it into a car. And Ira would just sit there. I mean, it's like what I remember of his desk is just a pile of shavings and Ira moving. And every now and then he'd say, I wrote this in my book, you know, with a couple more weeks, this could be a really nice model. And I've been over the last couple of years becoming more attuned to finer woodworking, mm-hmm. to gluing all my joints, to making the joints rabbeted or doweled, really making things that last. And it's a totally different mindset.
Sure, sure.
So this is part of that program. Right. I have collected a larger collection of planes and spoke shaves and things like that. And
right.
I'm really bringing them more into my process.
And so even without this particular thumb plane, just having small finger planes, small planes, is they're a very useful tool.
Absolutely.
If you're making things out of wood.
I've been making a bunch of scabbards lately. Mm-hmm. I have a large collection of swords, mm-hmm. and I have some that that don't have scabbards. And I have one, this Boromir sword, that Richard Taylor at Weta Workshop gave me.
Right.
And it's just one of the most beautiful objects I've ever seen. And it needs a proper scabbard. So I actually made three or four scabbards prior to Boromir's scabbard in order to practice so that I'd be ready for delivering. And even now, Boromir's scabbard has been built once, and I'm about to rebuild it.
And so this is where you might use
the finger plane came heavily into that. Right. Because I was actually carving out the inside in the profile of the blade out of both halves of a piece of poplar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, they're very, I mean, if you look at the old time stuff, cabinets and things, and you wonder, how could they make this without, by hand? This is how they do. They have these, often they would have tools that have all different kind of profiles. I mean, the planes would be contoured for like molding.
Yep.
And that's how they did molding in the old days.
My next door neighbor here at the cave, Bobby, is a super fine woodworker. Mm-hmm. And on his wall, he has like 30 planes. And I remember when I first moved in, I was like, why do you need more than one plane? And he was like, man, do you know how almost none of the furniture you have that's good was sanded into its shape? He's like, when you sand, you're pushing sandpaper into the sanding, you're pushing sawdust into the pores of the wood. He said, you want the relief, you want to bring out the wood, you've got to be able to plane at a cell at a time, and this is how you finish.
Right, exactly. That's true. So, Adam, what's another tool that you have?
The other tool is a sort of a twin tool. So at the business end is the newest kind of soldering iron that I have encountered, which is effectively a USB-powered soldering iron.
Wow.
that when you connect it up to a power source, and you can literally plug this into power input to a USB
of any type. I noticed you have one where you're having like a drill battery. Which
well,
has
this
an
is
adapter.
The other thing is that
okay. So well,
yeah.
We're
so this
ahead.
Is the second yeah. part. But this thing heats up to its full heat in about 10 seconds.
Wow.
Its heat is highly adjustable, and I have found it to be. I have never found a benchtop soldering iron to work for me to stay hot enough. I find really? The tips burn out, and part of it is my own shitty technique. Uh-huh. And so I use Weller right. butane-powered soldering irons. Mm-hmm. I find those to be a lot more versatile. But again, they wear out. This one is lighter and smaller and easier to use than I have yet discovered, mm-hmm. and it heats up so damn fast. And you can buy these on Amazon for about $50.
Wow. And what's it called?
I think what you'd look for is a USB-powered soldering iron with an OLED display. That's the thing that separates it out. It's got this active display so you can set its temperature precisely.
Is there a brand?
There are several different companies. I suspect there's a single factory branding this for several different companies because they kind of look incredibly similar.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But what I've plugged it into is a power supply that connects right up to one of my DeWalt FlexVolt 60 volt batteries. 60 volt max.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So there's been this whole new thing lately of add-ons for power tool batteries. Not only USB power supplies for powering your phone and external power supplies for powering things like this, but also, and Tom Sachs introduced me to this, there are main market and aftermarket adapters for any battery to almost any other cordless system.
I know.
And that gets me really excited.
In fact, there's a whole bunch of Thingiverse, 3D printer versions.
Oh, really?
Yes, where you can print out the plastic part.
That just does the adaptation
for you. Yeah,
right.
It does the A to B.
Wow.
Yes, because if you're stuck in one system, but you want to buy a tool that doesn't fit your system, this is what you need.
And that's the thing is actually because I do a lot of online ordering, it's actually very easy to buy a tool that doesn't have any batteries with it, which means you're not wasting a whole extra charging system that you need. And especially there are tool systems I prefer over other tool systems, but the idea that I could have a consistent battery across them all. I even have, DeWalt has a couple of different battery connecting styles. There are adapters from one to the other and back again.
Yeah, I was looking at the Milwaukee Sawzall, and I wanted one, but I think it was a Robie or something, DeWalt, and I was like, there must be an adapter. And there was, and there was even a place where you could print it out, and so you could take my DeWalt batteries and run the cordless Sawzall.
The idea that you can print those things out gets me really excited, just like the projects that many people have done of printing up universal brick adapters so you can connect to Lego, to Duplo, to Zoob, to whatever you want.
The another cool reuse of the DeWalt, the drill batteries, is the Amish take these and they have they use it as a base for a LED light.
Which will last for days and days and
days. It used to be, they used to have kerosene, that was the thing, and kerosene's smelly and it's flammable and it's dangerous. But the base of it, it works perfect.
Right.
As a
untippable.
It's heavy. So you go into Amish homes and they've got the DeWalt battery LED light.
Wow.
Which is solar recharged.
They've progressed way far beyond that rolling chair from Witness.
Yes. So, and if you go to like Amish swap meets, they have the third party people making, because they have a kind of a look, a standard white shade look.
Yeah.
And so they've adapted the Amish Endure Light to using these batteries.
That's wonderful. And they're not, I thought of the Amish as resisting technology.
No, they're late adapters.
Okay.
They, they're very late in adapting things, and they have two criteria that they apply collectively instead of individually, which is, will this thing, new thing in our life, bring us together more as a family, help us have all three meals at home?
Yeah.
And does it keep us in our community?
Wow.
Will it help us visit the sick on Sunday? Okay, so if it doesn't do those two things, then they're not going to use it. And so they have this long experiment with the Amish Alpha early adopters.
Wow.
Who are always getting permission to try something. And the bishop says, yes, Ivan, you can do that, but we're watching. We're going to see how this affects you and your family. And then you have to be ready to give it up if we decide that it's not good for you.
Those are phenomenally refined metrics,
right,
with which to examine a technology's
absolutely
utility.
Absolutely. And it's interestingly that they basically, parish by parish it varies, but they're basically accepting cell phones.
Fascinating. But right, not necessarily smartphones?
That remains to be seen.
Yeah.
But the idea is that because Amish have kind of dispersed and their families are often further away than they can reach to by horse.
Sure.
This brings their family together in the good way of social media.
Right, right. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So anyway, so batteries.
I think we'd all be better off if we were always examining those two metrics when thinking about a new technology.
Absolutely, 100%. I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does it make me a better person? Does it make our family stronger? Does it make our community stronger? And so so they're not averse to adopting new technologies, and they have solar stuff, which they like solar versus electricity from the grid, because they feel that when you're connected to the grid, you have obligations that go out. You are influenced by,
right,
you're tied to the world.
Yeah.
And here they feel like they have a little bit more, it gives them more of a power to do their own thing.
That's totally sensible.
Yeah.
I realize that each of these tools, in a way, has a specific way of bringing me closer to my work.
Yeah, right.
I didn't think of that as the unifying thing.
Right.
But while I work on large and small,
right,
projects, my favorite place to be is at the workbench, where everything's within about a 16-inch circle, and
right,
I'm just,
right,
sort of tying it all together. And each of these tools sort of allows me that,
right,
level of...
Well, that kind of intimacy with a little kind of thumb playing,
mm-hmm,
the ability to have a battery-operated soldering iron so you aren't tied to a long line, the same thing with the welding.
Yeah.
It's this idea of being closer,
yeah,
and more intimate with the work that you're doing.
Sometimes I think I'm simply a prepper testing tools.
So we wanted to take the last couple of minutes to talk about your newest project, something that you should be very proud of. It's a book. Having written books, they're like babies.
It is.
They take far more effort than you would imagine.
Than you're even prepared for.
But yeah, there's a delight in having finished it and having it out in the world. So tell us about it.
It's called Every Tool's a Hammer. Life is what you make it. Every Tool's a Hammer is a joke that my late friend and colleague Mark Buck used to say. Mm-hmm. He was this big 6.5 foot tall, lanky, acerbic, dry-witted model maker I worked with at ILM. He was a colleague of Tori Belleche and Grant Imahara's and I, and mine. And he used to say that like a sage, remember, in every tool there is a hammer. And it's a good maker joke because we've all misused things near us to hammer things. I've used my phone, and I'm pretty sure you have too. It's whatever heavy thing is nearby. But at the same time, I think that there is also a celebration of the expansion that an open mind can bring to a tool in front of you and find hidden possibilities within it. And I love that. One of Jamie's regular refrains about Mythbusters was misusing tools and materials for reasons they were never intended.
Right.
And yet there's so much magic,
right,
in that. And when I first started writing it, I sold the book on the idea that it would be about half instructional and half philosophical. That I would, the chapter I wrote first was called Use More Cooling Fluid, which was my answer to the question, what would you tell your young self if you had a time machine? And that was being a jokey, but
yeah,
I'm also addressing the fact that I am my own biggest enemy at the workbench.
Uh-huh.
I am super impatient. I want to move so fast to the next thing that at any transition point, I'm likely to lie on my back and drill upside down rather than take this thing apart and place it on my workbench in a way that I can address it correctly.
Right.
And so use more cooling fluid is the marker for the taking the time. So I began the chapter by describing the physics of cooling fluid,
okay.
cutting metal with metal, how heat moves and how powerful friction can be, and the actual physics mechanics of how a drill bit peels up metal. Mm-hmm. And then I got into the philosophical, and then I started telling these autobiographical stories about the ways in which I learned these lessons the hard way. But a funny thing happened is I started to try and look at other places where I felt I had a real, genuine grasp, not a researchable grasp, but a personal, intuitive grasp of technology that I would describe. With cooling fluid, I didn't have any problem with that. I wrote that almost as one block when I first wrote that whole physics explanation. But I felt there were very few other processes that I know that I consider myself at all an authority on. I am a generalist in the most broad sense of the world, and that I'm mediocre at almost all of my skills. Mm-hmm. My talent lies in combining them in different ways. And thus, the book became far more philosophical and far more autobiographical than I thought it would be, as I started to look for the places in which I thought I did have stuff to impart about list making, about utilizing deadlines, about sharing the load, sharing the pain, sharing the credit, sharing the enthusiasm. All of these things I consider intrinsic to the amazing people I get to work with and the success that I've enjoyed.
So this would be a book that might be half useful to someone who actually is making things, and maybe someone who isn't even making things, just in terms of encouraging them or inspiring them to try to make some things.
Exactly. So I have an entire chapter on glue, in which the beginning of the chapter I explain that I hate glue, that I think glue is the worst solution to any problem unless it's the only solution. And I avoid it like the plague because I don't like limiting my options.
And when you glue something, you're kind of stuck.
By definition. Right. And I use glue all the time, and I've used it over the years. Yeah. So I decided I'm not going to do a comprehensive chapter on glue. I'm going to tell you about the 7 glues I use and why those are the only 7, why I hate all-purpose glues with an all-consuming passion, even though they probably work fine for some people. And so in that chapter, I'm giving some instruction, but I'm also giving that instruction from a self-avowed singular point of view. And I think that that's also part of the instruction of the book that I weaved in there, which is every shop, every workspace, every execution is an externalization of the philosophy of the maker.
Yes.
It is a description, a physical description of how someone wants to work or thinks that work goes.
Right. It is an expression of themselves and not a trivial sense.
No.
In a very profound sense.
And in the way that when we are working at the bench, one of the other things I say repeatedly in this book is that, you know, the workspace is a holy space where we get to confront ourselves. Ultimately, when we're moving past the obstacles that we encounter, we're moving past our own biases, our own preconceptions. We are dealing with the fact that the project's never going to go where we think it's going to go, and the real trick for us is to follow it where it's going to go, and that within that, the respect for that dichotomy to me is everything. That is like my experience of the universal other. Of, I start out on this trip, I point on a map, and then I get into the vehicle of my shop, and we drive miles from there.
Ultimately, making something is kind of no different than making a life. I mean,
indeed,
you're kind of bringing the same kinds of skill set, and it's really the same kind of a journey that in the end you are making a life in the same way that you make a box.
It's so funny you say that. Years ago, I was lucky enough, I was 18, 19 years old. I got to spend a week in the woods of Connecticut taking an intensive 10-day camping music course from Susan Osborne, an incredible vocalist who lives up on Orcas Island, and David Darling, a cellist who was the lead cellist for Paul Winter for many years, Paul Winter consort. But David has also played with all of the jazz greats, and I knew him back in the 80s in New York. And at one point, he was just having us sit around with all of our instruments and play a sound. And he had us play a sound, and then he said, I'd like you to try and play a sound, and I would like you to think about the sound that you're playing, the note that you're playing, as having the arc of a complete human life within the beginning and the end of that note.
Wow.
Hold that orientation in your head as you blow that note.
Wow.
Yeah.
So making a note is making a life. But no, it's true that the journey of making a box is really the journey of making a life times a million. I mean, it's just an expanded thing. The setbacks, is the same idea that you are in some ways some kind of a synthesis between directing it and being directed at the same time, where you are following the work, but also you are bringing something to the work.
And this is the thing about, you know, I love pointing out that the workbench is where I get to experience the vicissitudes of life in a safe place.
Right.
And in the same way that, you know, we sit there in bed with our partners at the end of the day workshopping how to handle our kids and deal with our lives and how we want our lives to feel and how we want them to go.
Mm-hmm.
And we make some decisions and we leave others for later and mm-hmm. we see how things work out and then we adjust as we go.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing happens on the bench.
Right.
Except on the bench, I also get the added pleasurable fiction of pretending that the universe has order and that I have some measure of control over it. Both of which are very convenient fictions.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's the pleasure, is that you can actually, and also that things have they come to an end. You finish something.
Yeah.
And your life generally is, hopefully, unfinished.
Yeah. We're all, as Tom Sack says, we're all dying with a to-do list.
As long as your to-do list doesn't kill you.
Right. It was a far more personal exercise writing the book. So right now in our shop, we're surrounded by a bunch of my spacesuits.
Uh-huh.
And for each of these spacesuits, there's an abiding way in which I have the entirety of each one of these mm-hmm. in my head.
Yes.
And there are ways in which the suit itself is almost more of a gesture in my head than a collection of materials and actions and ideas and solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And I expect that for authors, that books can often become that way. I actually had dinner with John Scalzi last week, mm-hmm. and I asked him, and he was like, oh yeah, I have muscle memory for how books are shaped for me, but it took me 15 books.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I'm not used to working on a project that feels like so many disparate parts.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, the point at which the book coalesced into a singular whole for me was when I recorded the audiobook over 14 hours in 3 sessions. Mm-hmm. That was the point at which I reconnected with all of the different parts mm-hmm. in a linear fashion. And that was a really lovely exercise.
I often tell people that I always wish I could write the book a year after I've written the book and given all the talks and done the audio recording, because then I know what the book is about.
Right, yes.
And now I should be able to write it.
Right.
Because I would do a much better job, because now I know what the book's about.
As Tarantino was asked about all the layers of complexity in his plots,
mm-hmm.
and he's like, I don't put them there on purpose. Mm-hmm. I write out how these characters interact, and only later do I learn from them
mm-hmm.
the cultural connections that are mm-hmm. that are going on.
Yeah. So books have their own lives in some ways, right? So the book is called
Every Tool's a Hammer. Life is What You Make It. I'm in the middle of a book tour now.
Okay.
I was in New York and Boston, Toledo, mm-hmm. Cleveland, and Pittsburgh last week.
Right.
I'm heading to Santa Cruz tonight, mm-hmm. Seattle tomorrow. And I'm finding, I've done a lot of public speaking.
You have.
I've spoken for everything from 2 people to 220,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
I have almost solely always been speaking to groups of people on behalf of a group enterprise, which has been mm-hmm. such a grace. My partnership with mm-hmm. Jamie and Carrie and Grant and Tori mm-hmm. and Michael Stevens and all my mm-hmm. other collaborators has been so fruitful, but this is really singular talking about this mm-hmm. book because it's so mine. What I'm finding is a real hunger from the audience to talk about the stuff that I talk about in the book,
mm-hmm.
about process and complication mm-hmm. and difficulty mm-hmm. and managing mm-hmm. A life between dealing with mm-hmm. the stuff of your life and dealing mm-hmm. with these things you can't stop paying attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people feel that their proclivities, what they would maybe call hobbies or crafts, are anathema to the functioning of their lives. Mm. And I, in the very introduction of this book, I say, I want this book to be a permission slip from me to you to follow that thing you can't stop paying attention to. Because if you do, you will find yourself and your excellence in that intersection.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that, that, you know, we have so many things to do that when it comes down to like, well, spending some time to make something that maybe is not as useful, we have to have an answer in our head of like why we're spending that time.
Yeah.
Why is that okay? You know, there's people starving in Africa.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of stuff. It's like, this is important? And the answer is yes.
Yes. Yes,
it is.
Because I think that it, for me, it's energy generating.
Right.
And in fact, when people ask me about the balance between my work life and my home life, that has been a constant and ongoing process for me, but one in which I have come to discover that the more I pay respect to the work that's in front of me, and also the more I keep my consciousness on the work and the family all in an orientation to each other, far from feeling like the work is taking away from family or the family is taking away from work, both are generating energy towards each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's solely through a frame of consciousness in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I joke that I've been more distant from my family in the shop that's in the basement at times than I have recently been in a shop that's 30 minutes from my house, simply because of the frame of my consciousness about my life, my my family.
Yeah. It's... That issue of, again, it transfers. I mean, those kinds of being able to have an answer, being able to have a perspective and making something in your shop will extend to all the other things that you make in your life. It's not just about making things in a workshop. It's about making a life.
Well, and when we say making, I also say in the very beginning of the book, it is so not just putting things together.
Right.
In fact, I tell a story about a kid coming up to me in one of the early maker fairs I was signing autographs at. And I ask everyone as I'm signing an autograph, what are you making? I'm at maker fair. And frequently I would hear, I don't make, I code. And I yelled, coding is making! And so many coders are tweeting to me and writing to me through social media saying, thank you. I didn't realize. I didn't feel like the thing I was doing was making. And my definition is as broad as when you use your brain to bring something into existence that didn't exist before, a poem or a song or a dress or a sewing machine, you haven't contributed to culture. You are part of it. You are part of that conversation. You're recapitulating the world around you through your hands or your body or your voice.
You aren't in traffic, you are traffic.
Yeah.
Right.
And And that's a beautiful frame. It puts you into the world in an abiding way.
Right. No, it's a central human act to create, to make. We are, you know, we are inherent builders and makers altering the environment. We can't help it. And so we might as well do it well. Might as well do it in a way that is the most productive, the most opening of choices, the most conducive and productive for us, the best for our families. There are different ways to make.
Yeah.
And your book is somewhat about a better way to make or a good way to make.
I know you love books as much or even more than I do. And one of the things I love about looking at books of people's work and output is whether it's photography or painting or sculpture or movie making, every time I'm reading a good one, it makes me itch to do that thing.
Right.
To get started and get my hands dirty.
Right.
And that was one of the few things I realized during the writing of the book, this is what I want this book to yield in the world.
And you mentioned one of the ways you changed during the book, which was maybe a little bit more autobiographical than you thought. Did you change your mind about anything while you wrote the book from the beginning to the end? Was there some shift in perspective that...
There was a deepening of perspective in a lot of different ways.
Okay.
I started playing around with the rhetorical flourish of using physics terms to describe emotional processes.
Mm. Okay.
And so I came up with the idea of calling... first up was the idea of momentum. And in physics, momentum involves an object at rest stays at rest unless acted upon by the outside force. An object in motion stays in motion. And for me, the physics of creation are obsession is the way I keep that momentum going. And there are other ways I keep the momentum going. I keep it with lists and with checkboxes, and I talk about that. Deadlines help me get things done. So I talk about momentum from a physics and emotional perspective. I then talk about obsession, and as I was writing about obsession and I was thinking, oh, what is the physics equivalent of obsession? Holy shit, obsession is the gravity of making. That everything you do that is...
That's cool.
That is pushing yourself to the limit of what you... It requires a little bit of past normal attention.
Right.
And you scratch the surface of any athlete, cyclist, sandwich maker, and you're going to find someone who's like, I got to find the right ratio of turkey to mayonnaise for this goddamn sandwich. I got to figure out where Jerry Rice is going to be when I throw this ball and I can't see him.
And you can't... And there's no option about not doing it.
Right.
It's, you're just being pulled. It's like we don't get a choice about whether there's gravity. There's just gravity, and we have to deal with it.
Well, I think I certainly feel that pull. I was raised with that pull as a value. I was raised by parents who paid real respect to the, oh, I got to do this. My dad painted for 3 to 5 hours every day of my childhood. That's an incredible example.
I've been working on a book, another book of photographs of Asia, old disappearing parts of Asia. And there, as I examine it, I spent an enormous amount of energy doing this. There's no commercial value. There's probably very few people who are really that interested in it. There's no economic reason for me to do it. There is no, I mean, it's often work in the sense of tremendous amount of effort and to maybe a small, meager yield. But I find that I have no alternative but to do this. It's like I just have to do it. It doesn't make sense. There's no logic. It's completely useless in a certain sense, but it's cool.
Yeah.
Cool and useless. And that compulsion is, I've sort of come to just accept it. It's like I'm not even going to justify it.
Yeah.
I just like, it just needs to be done.
I remember, again, being 19. And having an ex of mine when we were together saying, why are your sculptures so violent? They shouldn't be this violent. And I said, your question presupposes that I have a choice in the matter. I'm a child of my culture, and this is, I was, you know, my sweet spot of adolescence was the early 80s, like one of the most fertile science fiction fantasy film eras in the 20th century. So that's the language that I am recapitulating through these pieces. The presuppose, now when I hear myself saying that, hearing 19-year-old me saying that, I mean, I'm being a little full of shit because I wasn't examining in myself that violence. And she's right. That was worth and necessary to examine while that's happening.
Right. But it probably, you got it out and you probably don't.
Yeah.
Have
oh no and you know it took me yeah there were lots of things I was recapitulating. It took me 5 years of sculptures to get H.R. Giger out of my system. I had to imitate him so many times to figure out what I needed out of his work.
I have also surrendered to the idea that I'm going to imitate in the beginning. I just blatantly I'm imitating, I'm copying, I'm trying to do this. That's what needs to be done. That's the first step.
Mary Carr, who wrote Liar's Club, one of my favorite memoirs ever. She says, when asked about writer's block, what do you do when you're at your work table and you have writer's block? And she said, I pick up the writing of someone I love and I copy it in longhand. She says, my fidelity at the table is to write.
Right.
And if it's not coming from me, I will take someone else's words and feed them through my body.
Brilliant.
That is so, it is such a powerful image. She's so right. And at the beginning, because all creation is karaoke.
After about two paragraphs, you'll just start to veer away on your own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have to do that imitation in order to understand it from the inside.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you learn so much by doing it too.
The other physics concept that came late in the book that might be my favorite, because at the end of the book I say, I'm trying to face myself, but I'm also trying to be gentle. Because we are our own harshest critics. is I started talking about the physics of tolerance within machining and manufacturing.
Oh, tolerance.
For instance, your expensive Mercedes engine costs a lot more than your Kia because those parts are made to a higher tolerance, which means fixing them is more expensive, but it also means that driving them gives you totally different amounts mm-hmm. of feel. Rolls-Royce's famously mm-hmm. high tolerances, etc. But then I talk about the tolerance we have for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And in the same way that when you want something to be able to, when Jamie and I wanted a crash test dummy mm-hmm. that could survive being dropped out of a helicopter, we made one, not that wouldn't break, we made one that we could put back together very quickly because mm-hmm. it was always going to break. The question was how quickly would our reset be? So we mm-hmm. built this thing with crazy tolerances, quarter inch tolerance between this rod and that mm-hmm. hole. Mm-hmm. But that meant that putting it back together was trivially quick. And that the tolerance that allows you to treat your tools more roughly mm-hmm. or to treat your creations more roughly or be able to exist in harsher conditions is the same thing about the tolerance with ourselves. When we have more tolerance for ourselves, we can handle more of these vicissitudes and not get down on ourselves mm-hmm. because we do. Mm-hmm. We, you know, obstacles kick my ass still sure. every day, and nothing insulates us from that.
But like tolerances, you have different tolerances for different parts of your life.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, so like honesty, what's the tolerance? It should right. be pretty, pretty high.
Yeah. Yeah,
right?
Indeed.
Yeah. But, you know, in terms of like mercy or honesty in others and stuff, okay.
Yeah.
We're going to be a lot wider there.
And it's funny that you say that. I remember once having someone who I thought was a friend, and I confronted them about an issue I had with them. And in my opinion, I'm very non-confrontational. So if I'm confronting you or anybody, it is because I'm investing in our relationship. Uh-huh. It's because I consider our relationship yeah. important enough and giving enough that I'm going to, we'll suffer through this yeah. together to get past this point. And I confronted him about a thing, and he lied to my face about his motivation. Yeah. I knew it was a complete lie. Uh-huh. And at that moment, I was like, oh, there's my tolerance for him. Right. Now I know the limit of what I will invest uh-huh. into this friendship, and uh-huh. it just ended a minute ago.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. So that's a beautiful analogy, I think. Wonderful, the physics to our private lives.
And I attempted a few more uh-huh. of that rhetorical flourish, and okay. my editor was like, yeah, let's not get too clever with ourselves. And I really appreciate that. You know, it unceasingly amazes me. I wrote a column for Wired uh-huh. for a year, and Adam Rogers was one yeah. of my editors. Uh-huh. And a good editor makes me wonder why I'm getting sole credit.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
the ways in which they help me. Matthew Benjamin, and, also on my team, Nils Parker, helped me understand the framework of this book and how to get these things to connect each other. Because we went from 8 chapters to 10 chapters to 16 chapters down to 12 with an introduction. Mm-hmm. It was a long process.
I've been on both sides. And my stance generally being, having been edited by editors and editing, is the editor is always right. It solves a lot of the problems.
I totally agree with that. It's a totally reasonable way to proceed.
I mean,
unless the
default. Right. But generally, that's where we start.
Yeah.
Well, this is really wonderful. I wish you the best for the people out there. Every tool is a hammer.
Life is what you make it.
Life is what you make it.
More information at adamsavagebook.com. Also, on adamsavagebook.com, you'll find information about where I'm traveling around the country.
Okay.
And you can come out and see me and ask some questions, because honestly, the interactions I'm having with audiences is so moving. Yeah. They are so moving. I had the other night in, I think it was Cleveland, this little girl stood up and said, she was made of 12 years old. She's like, I was working on a project at school and I got it almost done. And I realized that it just, the way I had approached it was wrong and it wasn't working. And so I decided to scrap it and start from scratch way close to the deadline. And my lab partners were all upset because they thought it was mostly done, but I didn't. So I'm wondering what you think about that. Mm. And I was like, come over here and give me a high five because I'm going to be working for you someday. If at 11 you have the fortitude to resist the slings and arrows of your peers and know I have to build this again from scratch. I said the power of scrap of wiping the workbench and starting from scratch is one of the hardest lessons for a maker to learn.
It is. For anybody, yes. any creator, to know when you have to start over.
It's a powerful moment.
Yeah.
And sometimes sometimes I'll hit a wall with a project in here and I'll have to put it away for 6 months in order to get back to the, I got to start this from scratch.
Yeah. Well, this has been really great. Adam,
Kevin,
thank you for having me here.
I love talking to you,
surrounded by things that have been made by you and others. and we'll do this again sometime.
We will.
Okay.
Soon.
Great.
Thank you, sir.
Yep. Thank you.